So hi, Cameron and Steph. We're delighted that you're joining Linda and I today. Linda and I lead teams at Prospectus. We lead a governance practice and an executive search practice, respectively. And increasingly, we have been asking ourselves and the sector the question about disability in leadership. In senior leadership roles, in boards, and in the governance of organisations. And we want to understand more about what we can do as recruiters. We want to understand how we can better support great candidates into our processes. And we've asked you, as people that we've worked alongside, and whose opinions we really value and trust, to help us open up the conversation a little bit. We're really delighted that Steph Cutler is here with us. Steph is the founder of Making Lemonade, which is an inclusive talent and workplace consultancy. Steph's also a trustee of the Shaw Trust and is also a non-executive director of our very own Prospectus. So thank you for being here, Steph. And Cameron Malik is the Chief Executive of Disability Rights UK, national Pan Disability Disabled Persons Organisation led by disabled people for disabled people. Cameron's also has a number of board and trustee roles, notably with the Lyric Hammersmith and Lloyds Bank Foundation as well. And Linda, can I hand over to you just to open and kick off the first question in the conversation? Thanks.
Yeah, and just, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of, and what I'm looking forward to hearing about more today is, I guess, having appointed Cameron into your role at Disability Rights UK over 4 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, 4 years and 1 month.
Fantastic. And I remember really vividly how exciting it was to receive, you know, over, I don't know, 60, 70 applications from people with a lived experience of disability applying for that role. And it was a really competitive and wonderful process. And of course, the, you know, right candidate got it at the end. That why haven't those individuals, you know, continued to apply to other chief executive roles and many that we've done since? Or even before, and I'm really interested in us exploring that and understand a little bit about what the issue is here and what I guess we all collectively need to do about it.
Yeah, thank you, Linda and Jess. So really good question. Why don't more disabled people apply to positions either as chief execs or board positions? And I think, so I applied for Disability Rights UK because my career was on that path of wanting to be in a kind of that advocate role of bringing about change. And actually within those opportunities, they're few and far between. So there are not that many organizations like Disability Rights UK that are specifically focused on working with and for disabled people to bring about change in the wider community. So those opportunities are often quite low, and there are many disabled people that are on that path of wanting to bring about change from their lived experience. I think that's one reason why I think Disability Rights UK had a significant number of applicants. So why those people then don't go to other organisations or other disabled people? Because when we talk about numbers of disabled people, you know, 15 to 20% of the population are disabled people. So why are those people not applying? I think it's about whether you see yourself reflected in that organization's values, in you know, how they might advertise, the kind of imagery they might use, the wording, the terminology they use. So unless you see that, you may just think that's not an organization that is looking for me with my particular knowledge and unique set of skills and assets that I could bring. And I think that's one of the reasons people don't choose to go for other organisations, I'd say. I'm sure, Steph, you've got lots of thoughts on this.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great question. It's a question that doesn't get asked often enough. So it's brilliant to have this opportunity to start to explore it a little bit. I think there is some sort of comfort that disabled people might feel in applying for any role, but we're talking about senior roles, perhaps board level roles, senior level roles, when it's about something where their lived experience is a big asset. It's a definite, almost like skill and qualification, if you like, to assist in being able to do that role really, really well. So I think there's a natural fit there, which that natural fit doesn't appear necessarily in other places, certainly as well. And I think there is something, yeah, you're right, Cam, about if you don't see people like you, then it's harder to imagine you being there and them wanting you. I think there is very, very likely not quite the issue that it first appears. So it appears as though there are not many disabled people and people with long-term health conditions at board levels and in senior positions. And I imagine that it definitely is far too low. And yet there will be many more than it appears, because lots of people will hold those roles. They won't self-identify as disabled. Their impairment or health condition will be non-visible, and they will choose not to share that they live with an impairment or health condition. And whilst that is absolutely their right and, you know, their choice not to share, whilst they don't, it perpetuates this idea that there aren't people in those positions with lived experience. And so it doesn't help both non-disabled people think, oh yeah, it's possible, and disabled people can think, well, there's no one like me. So I think there is an issue. I suspect it's not quite as big an issue as it might first appear. But then why are those people not sharing? That's a relevant question as well.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think there are far more disabled people in those positions or near those positions.
Yeah.
But choose not to disclose, and you make a judgment call on the kind of risk versus reward of being open and honest about your hidden impairment. And the reason you often choose not to disclose, so I have no choice, I'm a wheelchair user, I can't hide it. But for other friends and colleagues who I know who've chosen not to disclose it, it's from a fear of what the assumptions might be made about them as a result. And that's such a shame, isn't it? Because that's actually the opportunity we want people to, businesses and organizations to encourage people that this is an asset. This is not something to be afraid of. This is something we want in our business, because what comes with it is a lifetime experience of doing things differently that any business is going to benefit from. So it's that risk reward, I think, is the judgment people make, and organizations and businesses have got to push it so it's more about reward.
Absolutely, yeah, because I'm registered blind and yet have a non-visible impairment. So for maybe not the entire process, or certainly if I was to be successful, I would definitely choose to share, but I still have a choice whether I choose to share about my impairment or not. Now I tend to, but it is a choice, and I understand why people don't, and I understand why people do. But I think we need to start getting to a place where it's much more comfortable and much more acceptable and much more welcoming for people to share what they bring. And I think that's what it is. It isn't just what I need, it's what I bring. And we need to frame that conversation very differently, both as organisations, but as disabled people, like how we view ourselves and how we present ourselves. You know, as a disabled person, there are things that I need, but actually there's much more that I bring than I need. And that's the key bit. Just for all of us to get through each day, we use so much creativity and innovation and resilience and all sorts of amazing leadership skills. And yet either we don't see it in ourselves because it is just our everyday, or we're just so flipping good at it that it's just what we do, and we don't then share it in that way that says, look, you know, this is me and this is how I operate. Therefore, this is what I bring. And, you know, I think other people need to be much more looking at it as an asset-based approach to including disabled people in the workplace and in senior positions.
So yeah, absolutely. I was itching to kind of get in there. Because it's so interesting, because it leads me to think about why do disabled people not take the risk, and what I would say to any leaders who are watching this is to say, you have an obligation to have a conversation about this. Your business should be honest and open and transparent about, none of us are perfect, that you haven't got it all right, but you're on that journey, and kind of opening the door to allow potential applicants to have that conversation with you. How can we do things better? How can we help you be the best that you can within our business? And kind of to learn more, just yourself, just to find out about what is it that's stopping people. Because a lot of people, disabled people, won't disclose because of what life has shown them. That if you talk about it, bad things will happen, or the opportunities won't be there. And that's something that's in society. And business is a part of society, and, you know, the people in society work in business. So if businesses can be the leaders in having the conversation, normalizing the conversation, that starts to change society's perceptions and views.
Yeah, I think organizations need to be willing and show willing, and that they are two separate things, you know, that linked, but you have to show willing. You have to be proactive about your willingness to want the likes of me and you, Cam, to join their board, to join their senior leadership teams. You know, I think there's something in that, you know, just to sit back is not enough. And I think actually very often disability is some way down. I know more and more organizations do much, much more around diversity and inclusion. And yet it's quite often disability is not even mentioned sometimes. And I think organizations don't quite know what to do around disability in the same way that they might know more easily what to do around, let's say, gender. And they're all important, but we need to be higher up on the agenda in terms of getting some attention and some thinking around what can we do, because it's disheartening to hear that you had 60 plus amazing applicants for one role, and then where do those people go? Because they're really talented people. We've just heard what a competitive recruitment drive that was. Where do those people go? And I'm always struck by when we think, talking in these terms, that there is not the same disparity between disabled people being entrepreneurs and business owners compared to non-disabled people being entrepreneurs and business owners. More and more disabled people do it for themselves and do it well. And you need a lot of leadership skills to run a business, to be an entrepreneur. And yet they choose to do it by themselves, for themselves, rather than within an organization. Yeah. So it can't be therefore about competence.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think interesting talking about the statistics and the declaring piece, right? Because we know, and something we're really keen to work on at Prospectus, we did our you know, diversity and equality and inclusion statistics there last 12 months. Only 6% of our, you know, chief executive and director and board appointments declared a lived experience of disability. And like you say, there is an awful lot of profile and talk, and oh my goodness, you know, there absolutely needs to be around gender and race and lots of other different backgrounds. Why isn't disability being talked about more?
I think why isn't it being talked about more? Disability has always been kind of the hidden diversity agenda. It's the kind of silent majority, if you like. You know, there are 20% of the UK population. It's not something we talk about. Things have started to change. So if you just look at the conversation about mental health, it's dramatically shifted in the last, I'd say very recently, in the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years, there's been a massive shift in normalizing the conversation about mental health. But we're not there yet with normalizing the conversation about disability. And I think we need to be thinking about diversity as a complete issue rather than kind of segmenting people into women and race and disability and so on. we're a mixture of all those things, and disability is one of those ones that kind of goes across all of the diversity strands. You can be disabled and a woman and of colour and so on. And so many of the barriers that people will experience are often quite similar. The whole idea of what someone can and can't do, the prejudging people based on how they look or who they are. So there are often lots of similarities across the different diversity stands. And yet, when I often talk to companies, they're saying, you know, this year we're talking about women, next year we're going to do race, and then we might get to disability in year 3 or 4. And these are big, you know, big companies that are quite open about saying that to you.
I hear that a lot too. And I think it's, I feel like it's not the right approach. Like you say, it's about thinking more inclusively about diversity, actually. And I think, and I agree that there are lots of similarities in terms of people's perceptions based on something that they see or think they know about you. I think the thing with disability that sometimes maybe makes it a bit trickier is that idea about there's other stuff we're going to have to do, and maybe that's going to cost some money, and maybe we haven't got accessible space, and you know, all this stuff starts to whirl around in people's minds about what they think you might need, which wouldn't happen if you were just looking at me as a woman. And yet if you look at me as a disabled woman, suddenly you're like, oh my goodness, well, we don't produce things in Braille, you know, without knowing that I don't read Braille and need Braille, you know, and lots of assumptions about what you're going to need, which are not based on reality. So I think there is that additional thing. And I think there is quite, there's some sort of shame sometimes around disability, and it can be seen as a weakness just in terms of how it's presented in society. And so, you know, if you're talking about leadership, weakness and leadership doesn't really go together, does it? You're expected to be strong, and how can you be strong when you've got this condition?
Yeah, and that's the piece, isn't it, where, you know, I was saying earlier about organizations have an obligation and leaders have a role in changing that narrative, working with disabled people, working with us to say we're actually going to change the narrative about our lives and your lives. Because you're right, the perception of disabled people in society is not a positive one. We don't hear very many positive stories. How many role models can we all put our name to and say, here's a list of 5 disabled role models that I aspire to, and I'm not a disabled person? You know, how many people would say that? Because most depictions of disability in the media, in the movies, in TV, in stories, is about less able, not the same as the other person, something wrong, that kind of narrative is, and that we all absorb that. I think we not consciously, you know, we talk about unconscious bias, that's what it is, isn't it? That's the bias that we have, that we don't consciously do it. We don't overtly want to be horrible. It's just, there's something inside us that drives us to think that way, and to avoid that conversation.
And it's not just non-disabled people who absorb that, you know, as people with lived experience, you absorb that as well. And so it's in no way does that help when you're talking about leadership roles and governance roles and that sort of thing. I think also sometimes disabled people make assumptions too. So they sometimes will make an assumption, like they no doubt did about the Disability Rights UK role, that it's by and for disabled people. So it's going to be like really accessible, really inclusive. And I know it is with you, but sometimes disabled organisations, you know, there is an assumption they're going to be brilliant at accessibility, and then therefore organisations that are not by and for disabled people just simply won't get it, and they won't want to know. And I've got experience in both camps, and I know there are some absolutely brilliant disability organisations out there, but I have been part of some where I've had less than good experience. In fact, I've left a board off the back of them not meeting my fairly simple access requirements consistently, and they were a disability organisation. And then I've joined, like, well, Prospectus is a good example. You know, it's a very inclusive, accessible board for me to sit and contribute on, and yet it's not a disability-led organisation. And so I think, you know, as disabled people, we sometimes assume organisations that don't have disability at the heart of what they do or part of what they do, that they're not going to get it and they're not going to be any good. And I think increasingly corporates and other organisations like in the beyond profit sector, they're sometimes better than the charities for whom we expect more of. Absolutely. Is that fair, Cameron, or not? That's just my experience.
No, I think you're absolutely right. If you look at leadership within the third sector, it's not as if that's representative.
No.
I'm not talking about just disabled people-led organisations. I'm just talking about in general. There are some very big national, international charities that when you look at the data, you just kind of surprised and almost shocked to think, why are they not getting it right when actually... what they talk about and what the persona is about this idea of equality and rights. So why are they not also following that? So I think it's a systemic issue within society, and charities and profit-making organizations, we're all part of that mix. And there's good and bad in all of those. And what we want to do is have more those that are good to lead the way and to bring others with us, to show the way, to say, this is how you do it. And it's not scary, it's not frightening, and you'll always get better results at the end of it. Because time and time again, data and research shows that when you have this diverse workforce, you have a mixture of people, you just get better outcomes because you've just got different perspectives. And all of the kind of myths about disabled people being off sick a lot and being at work a lot are just not true. There's just no data that backs any of that up.
And I think we're all getting better, you know, across you know, all sectors, definitely in terms of like the beyond profit sector. I think that argument about why diversity matters, I think we're largely sold on that. It's just when is disability going to be more highly regarded as a priority to feed into that narrative that everybody, I think, is pretty sold on, actually.
Yeah, and we kind of owe it, don't we, because I would hope the next generation of young people who are in college at the moment and the students who are coming out of university have a different perspective and come out aspirational with a desire to work and be, you know, I don't know, scientists and astronauts or whatever they want to be and work in tech and anything, that they will be met with this open door to say, yes, we want you in our business, rather than that kind of spending, as I did, a whole year knocking on doors and getting nowhere at the start of my career. And that really does put you off, because you then think, why put myself through this all the time? Because it's painful, it's demoralizing. And so I think, you know, the companies that we're talking about that are really kind of doing this well, it's incumbent upon them to lead the way and show others in their business and sector and not be precious about how they did it. Be open about it and say, this is how you can do it as well.
I think also the next generation of disabled people entering the labour market, whatever sector, you know, they are going to have higher expectations. I think they are going to expect more than generations that came before them. And so it's not going to be enough not to be ready to meet those expectations. You're just going to not gain from that talent pool if you're not much further ahead than have been in the past. I think the expectations of the next generation are going to be higher, and they will be expected to be met, and those that win. And I think the beyond profit sector should lead the way on this, because the nature of why we do what we do.
Yep.
And I think, Steph, that and Cameron, that we all feel that sense of optimism about the next generation who are coming up, around diversity in all of its forms and all of its intersectionality. I think there will be, things will feel really different, and I think that gives us lots to feel excited and optimistic about. But we know that within the leadership and the governance of the organisations that we're talking about, more needs to be done, more thinking, better doing, and action. we know that we're missing out, society is missing out, employers are missing out, the workplace is missing out on brilliant candidates. So what practical things can we be doing as employers and as recruiters? And what advice would you give to candidates, candidates who are kind of coming into the marketplace, coming into their working lives, and also who are looking to, get into a leadership role or get into a non-exec or a governance role? What advice would you give to those two groups? Top tips.
I think there's something around the candidates where actually, how are you presenting? How are you ensuring that actually what you bring is really evident to the employer, to the recruiter, to the hiring manager? Because actually, I think sometimes, and I work a lot with disabled people who are in work and want to get on in work, there's still a reluctance to really talk about what they bring in relation to their impairment. They almost put that to one side and then still talk about what they bring, because obviously that's what you do in these situations. When you start to talk about, well, actually, you do all this and you live with whatever they live with, that makes you everyday exceptional. You know, everyone has all of that stuff to bring, and we do it alongside living with whatever condition or conditions that we have. And that means that I think we are exceptional. We are everyday exceptional candidates. And until we start to think and frame things like that, we can't really complain when people don't get what we have to bring. So I think when people start to learn and think in those terms, I've seen some people who've been on some of the courses that I run, that they've had 3 promotions at, in the last 10 years, having been on one of our courses 10 years ago. You know, they just continue to get it and frame it and talk about it in a terms that makes it really difficult for people to say no to them. And so I think there is quite a lot candidates can do. It shouldn't all be the onus on them. I'm glad your question also included the other side, because the onus cannot all be on us. But obviously, as candidates, it is for us to put ourselves forward. And we can't say, well, we've disproportionately applied for that many roles. That's not fair, and that should not be. But if we stop applying, well, we're not going to get one. It is as simple as that. We do still need to keep putting ourselves out there and to believe and to have other people believe in us. If we don't believe in ourselves, well, that will come across. But I am quite loath to put it all on the disabled candidates, because...
Yeah,
another side to this, which hopefully Cameron, you can come in and speak on behalf of.
I would agree exactly what you're saying. However, what I would say is that I think for disabled people to be able to talk about their impairment as an asset is actually quite a leap, because throughout your life, it's never talked about as an asset. It's always talked about as a lack of an asset. It's something that's wrong. And so it's actually quite a leap. So I think people need support and guidance. So as a recruitment industry, it's about providing that guidance to say how you might want to talk about your impairment as an asset. It's about it, and the things you mentioned about being flexible and resilient and all those things. Why are those really important? Being kind of creative in solutions and things. So I think people need help with that. And that's some help that could also come through education. So when disabled people are going through education, they meet lots of professionals in their lives, careers advisors and so on. So I think this is kind of that. And then absolutely, as you say, once you know how to do that and you can see the benefits of it, it kind of, you just need to think, wow, why didn't I do this before? And it's kind of life changing. It's that light bulb moment. You think, I've always thought about myself as this deficit model, but actually it's not, it's the opposite. And so for businesses, I would be saying, look at the social model. Start thinking about the social model of disability, this idea that the reason people experience challenges and barriers in your world, in your business, or the things that you think about as the problems are the things that you can remove. So they're not about the individual. They're the physical barriers, they're the organizational policies and processes barriers, things that you do day in, day out that create barriers for people. And right now is a perfect time to think about it, because before the pandemic hit, disabled people would ask for reasonable adjustments, which were, I want flexibility, I want to be able to work from home part of the week or full time. And the answer often was, well, we don't do that, that's not how we work, we need you in the building. And suddenly, because of the pandemic, it's shown that actually businesses haven't collapsed because we're working from home. In fact, many have flourished, new ideas have come about, new models have existed, the tech has worked, the structures work. So that's a perfect example of kind of how we thought we couldn't, and we were just putting these barriers in front of people. Get rid of those. Just if you just swipe those or get rid of those things, it enables you to have access to this talent pool. So I'd say to businesses is look up, learn about the social model. It's a simple model, but it can be quite transformative in your thinking about how you approach these problems and how you think about disabled people.
And as somebody who acquired my disability, I acquired my impairment, and prior to it, I'd never heard of the social model of disability. And when I heard about it as a disabled person, it was really liberating. So, like, I think that's a great piece of advice for both parties, if you like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then apply that learning to when you're talking about your job opportunities, about your organization. Talk about how you're inclusive. What are the key things that you do that make you an inclusive business? And be open and honest about you're willing to learn, you're willing to talk to the candidate about any concerns they might have. You want to address them up front so that it doesn't hinder their kind of application and recruitment process. Use kind of in your imagery and in your marketing material, use this idea of the kinds of people that you have in your business, the diversity that you want, so that people genuinely see themselves in your promotional material. So when I pick up a pack, recruitment pack, it's wonderful if I see disabled people in that business. It's wonderful if I see people of different color and background and cultures. If that's truly representative of that business, I think, well, that, you know, I can fit in there because it's not all one shape or color that exists there. So reflect that in your promotional material.
I would say that, and I would say follow up. So sometimes I see even a pretty well-written inclusive statement that might say something about, we welcome applications from disabled people. If you need anything to make the recruitment process more accessible, please let us know. And that's encouraging. So you let them know, and then they haven't got a clue what you're talking about when you actually get to speak to somebody about it. And when you approach them and say, this is what I'm going to need, or could you consider this, or you start a conversation and then they just don't know how to respond or haven't really thought beyond writing that sentence in their recruitment pack, then that's immediately off-putting and it feels quite disingenuous. So I think, you know, show willing, but then really back that up with making sure your staff know how to respond when you get an application from somebody who wants to take up that invitation to have a conversation or to make a request for something that's going to make the interview more inclusive. And I think be flexible about how you interview. If we only interview in the same way all the times, we will definitely be missing out on giving people the opportunity who perhaps think differently and need things done slightly differently to really get to know them and understand what they might bring. I'm thinking there particularly around people with neurodiverse conditions. I think it's really important that we are prepared to be flexible about how we carry out interviews, for example.
Yeah, and one thing we talk a lot about in Disability Rights UK is the idea of co-produced solutions. Mm-hmm. So to a business, I would say, if you have staff who have kind of disclosed that they are disabled members of the team, include them on that journey, make sure they're part of it, learn from them, from their experience of applying. What could you do better, and be open and really transparent about, and a willingness to change. So kind of co-produce your journey with your own team and just have the conversation about disability and adjustments and what it means to have a truly inclusive workplace. Don't wait until you're having that conversation because a staff member comes to you and says, I need a reasonable adjustment. That's not the only time to have that conversation. It should just be part of your teams culture that you talk about. How do we allow you to be the best here? What are the blocks in your way? What's preventing you from performing to your absolute best? And that's not just for disabled people, that's all of us.
Yeah, so if you have those conversations regularly and actually you have something you would like to share but haven't perhaps shared previously, that's when you maybe are more likely to, because it's about feeling able to, because this is the conversations we have across the board. And for me, as an employer, as a recruiter, putting things in place is about an investment in talent. That's how I see it. It's an investment in talent. It's not about a costly intervention. It's simply if you invest in people, we all know you will get way more back.
Thank you both. Thank you so much. There's so much for us to unpick there, but it's also, you've been very, very focused and concise in providing brilliant examples and recommendations and suggestions for candidates, for recruiters, for employers alike. We really hope that this is a useful kind of jumping off point for people who are watching, who might want to engage more with the work, with the social model, with the work of Disability Rights UK, whose work is a powerful, powerful voice in the UK, and obviously Steph, your brilliant consultancy as well, Making Lemonade, and hope that candidates and boards and recruiters alike watching this will be able to think differently. Linda, going to ask you to just wrap up, if that's okay.
No, absolutely. To say thank you. Thank you for sharing. Thanks for your honesty. Thanks for your challenge. Key takeaways, and Jess and I will be reflecting, but you know, that asset-based approach. And I think what we can do more to help candidates communicate that effectively is really interesting. And of course, the importance of being flexible, right, in everything that we do. And thinking about, you know, helping really raise the profile of the complete issue of diversity and intersectionality. And I'm just going to ask people more regularly, how can I help you do your best here? I just think that's wonderful. I'd love people to be asking me that every day. So I think that's a great takeaway.
All that leaves me to do now, I think, is to thank you again, Cam and Steph, for sharing your thoughts and insight with us. That's been fantastic. I hope you all enjoyed listening to that, and we look forward to receiving your feedback.